Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Welcome back to Libromania, a podcast for the book obsessed featuring interviews with contemporary authors, discussions about key figures and movements in literary history, examinations of various genres and current events in the lit world, and celebrations of book nerddom, you know, bookstores, book design, book collections, and more. I'm David Kern. This is chapter 13, in which I chat with scholar and author Dr. Jessica Houghton Wilson about one of the world's most beloved authors, Fyodor Dostoevsky, and the besetting sin that dramatically affected his work and his life. Today, we're chatting about Dostoevsky's gambling problem.
And it's these striking opposite desires, like attraction and repulsion, that I think Dostoevsky is showing is part of the human person, especially if you're of the mind that we are both capable of so much good and capable of so much evil. He's showing us that. And he's laying it bare. And I think people are uncomfortable with the possibility of both failure and success in that extreme. Dostoevsky wants to go back to the good parts of medieval Russia and bring them up. What he would have wanted was this holistic vision, right? The idea that the church was the center of everything and the Russian spirit, right? The noble Russian spirit that had not been influenced. Dostoevsky wanted to go back to what he thought was pure Russia. And that if they did, then Russia could save the world. I mean, if there's any problems with Dostoevsky biographically, I don't think it's his gambling. I think it's the fact that he literally thought Russia would save the world if everyone became Russian.
Somewhere around midway through his absurdly thorough magisterial award-winning biography of Dostoevsky, Joseph Frank, a professor at Stanford and Princeton, recounts the story of the day that Anna, Dostoevsky's second wife, first met the author. She already knew about him. She was a fan, you might say, having read Crime and Punishment. And when she walked into his little apartment to begin working for him as a stenographer, she was shocked to realize that Dostoevsky's apartment looked almost exactly like the way he described Raskolnikov's apartment in Crime and Punishment. In that moment, Anna realized just how much of himself Dostoevsky poured into his novels. Not just in the sense that he worked very hard at them, but in the sense that he fashioned them, at least in some sense, in his own image. It can be a dangerous thing to read too much of an author's biography into his storytelling, but it's pretty clear that in Dostoevsky, we have an author who used his work to help process his own inner life, the anxieties and fears and neuroses that attended him every day. This, of course, is not unique to Dostoevsky, but it is fascinating, albeit sad at times, to see how that plays out in his decidedly unique, if not genius, novels. One of the things about which this great author writes with particular profundity is sin, the ways it eats at us, the ways it moves us, the ways it alters us. And I believe he's able to write so profoundly about sin because he's able to both see his own sins and share them with us. He was, some might say, an open book. In particular, we know that during the 1860s, Dostoevsky was beset by what we would call today a gambling addiction. Burdened by many debts and other difficult challenges, he turned to roulette as a way of making ends meet. But eventually it became more than that. It became a constant temptation and a source of shame. And as Dr. Wilson explains in this episode, it was during this period that he was trying to finish a novel commissioned by one of his creditors, a way of forgiving his debts. That novel eventually became The Gambler, a first-person psychological portrait of a young man whose destructive addiction to the gambling tables of Europe mirrors its creator's own addiction. Thanks to Anna, that young woman I mentioned earlier, the one who entered his apartment and who eventually became his second wife, that book was turned in on deadline and his debts were paid. For a while. That besetting sin just didn't go away that easily. So I wanted to chat with Dr. Wilson, who's written two books on Dostoevsky, about this part of his life and how these struggles showed up and impacted his novels, which of course are some of the greatest novels ever written in any language. Dr. Wilson is the author of three books, including Giving the Devil His Due, Flannery O'Connor and the Brothers Karamazov, which came out in 2016, and Walker Percy, Fyodor Dostoevsky, and The Search for Influence from 2017. Currently, she is preparing Flannery O'Connor's unfinished novel, Why Did the Heathen Rage, for publication, and she has spoken at venues across the world, from high schools and universities to churches and embassies, on topics ranging from the nature of suffering to the joy of poetry. So with that, let's get you over to my conversation with Dr. Wilson. Enjoy. Well, first of all, again, thank you for taking some time to do this. I've been wanting to talk about this conversation with someone who knows what they're talking about for a long time, so I'm excited.
I'm looking forward to it.
So here's what I was thinking about as I was researching and reading and thinking about this subject. Like many authors, you know, of his era, Dickens comes to mind. I mean, there's many of them. Dostoevsky wrote at least partly out of desperation. You know, he had to make ends meet and he had many debts. He had things like that that were, you know, probably it felt like encroaching on his creativity at times. But it seems like he also kind of wrote into or about his desperation and his anxieties and his fears more than most people, or at least as much as anybody that I can think of. So would you say that it's fair to say that his work was in some ways consumed with or by his own failures and flaws? And that, well, I'll just leave it at that.
Whoa, that's a fantastic question. And I think as Americans, we are so scared of talking about failure that it's a really interesting lead-in to discuss why people either love or hate Dostoevsky and how comfortable they are with failure.
I hadn't thought about it from that perspective. That's a great point.
Yeah, well, I feel like you just made it. So I think that it might be one of those things, because Dostoevsky really strikes people as this is their prophet, right? This is what they want to listen to, and he speaks into their own life. And then other people just turn away from him as, you know, dark and misanthropic, and they really are turned off, perhaps, by what you're talking about, that he just lays all these faults before you. And so when you look at his novels, he's always having, especially if they're in first person, confession. So you have something that's from the underground. He's confessing to us, right? Even though he says, I'm not confessing, and I'm confessing, and I lied just now when I said I... And then, of course, The Gambler, he's also constantly saying, I confess. And it's these striking opposite desires, like attraction and repulsion, that I think Dostoevsky is showing is part of the human person, because especially if you're of the mind that we are both capable of so much good and capable of so much evil, he's showing us that. And he's laying it bare. And I think people are uncomfortable with the possibility of both failure and success in that extreme. Mm.
You mentioned that he's constantly saying in The Gambler, I confess. And it seems to me like in some ways it's less of a, you know, sort of argument for confession, or, you know, saying confession is necessary and all that, as much as it is just him saying, I have to get this off my chest. Mm-hmm. You know, his fiction in some ways becomes, you know, a way to, well, confess. I mean, it doesn't seem like he's really hiding behind it. You know, he's kind of just all out there in some ways.
Right. No, he lays it bare. And even if you read Dostoevsky's biography from the beginning, when he was a kid, even there's accounts from his parents where they said he was kind of like that. He was really intense and moody and almost like high strung and hot headed and just wavering between these extremes, even more maybe than other Russians would be.
Huh. So, you know, I was reading the Frank biography. Well, I part of it. I haven't read the whole thing. It's pretty long. The Joseph Frank one. But he references in there the diary or the I guess the autobiography of his second wife, Anna. And how when she arrives to work with Dostoevsky, be his, was she a typist or something like that? The first thing she walked into his house and she thought, this looks just like Raskolnikov's house in Crime and Punishment. And how it both kind of repulsed her and was kind of exciting at the same time. So it's even interesting to think he described this murderer who he creates for Crime and Punishment in some ways is at least partly based on himself, or maybe maybe that wasn't even intentional. Do you think he was intentionally trying to be confessional, or it was something that just kind of came out of him and he couldn't help it? And whether he even recognized he was creating his own apartment or not, it just was because he couldn't avoid it.
Dostoevsky's genius is that he does lay himself out there. And when you read letters, when he was writing the brothers Karamazov, he says something along the lines of, all three brothers are me. I've pulled all three of them from myself. So he recognized that he had the potential to be an Ivan Karamazov or a Raskolnikov, right? He had the potential to kill someone for his ideas. He also had the potential to be Alyosha. But that was there, right? That he could also be saved. The gambler says this too, right? I want to be born anew. I could be resurrected. The possibilities were always within him for both. And so when he describes his apartment, you know, that is the dark, sad, poor side of him. At one point, I think he was, when he was so poor, he was living just off tea. I mean, just like Raskolnikov, kind of the crazy fever that you go under because you have no food and no sleep. And some of those things really were happening to Dostoevsky when he was at his poorest.
Which I suppose in some ways leads into this story of him having a gambling problem, because, you know, it was certainly in some ways tied to a desperation about money, as kind of an anxiety about it. Do you think, from what you know, was that something that he struggled with from a young age?
I think that's one of the problems that the Dostoevsky estate always confronts, is that people make so much about his gambling, but his gambling was, you know, always look up dates with me, but 1863 to 1871. And I'm sure of the date that he stopped. I think it was around 1863 when he started gambling. And yeah, that's right. Because his wife and brother died 1864, I mean, very early into his gambling problem. And so it didn't begin as a problem. But all of a sudden, when his wife and his brother died, he is in charge of his wife's son, was not his son, so it was his stepson after only a few years of marriage. And then he was also in charge of his brother's family, right? And all of this, and he's not a famous novelist. And he just got out of prison, right? He spent like 4 years in Siberia. And so he didn't, and his family wasn't wealthy, so he didn't inherit an estate. He had been trained as an engineer and hated it. So he didn't have a livelihood from his schooling. And now he has all of these dependents and no way to pay for them. So he started gambling actually as a way to give back to other people, not really for himself, to make money for himself. And then it just began to be an addiction.
Do you think that people, you mentioned a lot of people are, I don't know if you said obsessed with it, but you know, a lot of people talk about it. Do you think that people are overly critical of him about it?
Yes. I remember being in a class at Baylor University. I was doing theology class on Dostoevsky. So we were looking at Brothers Karamazov for his theology, specifically his knowledge of God. And some of the theologians, so not literature scholars, pressed on, why are we reading this guy that had such a monstrous sin in his life to try to understand what he knows of God? Which is a really perplexing question. And it's one that comes up all the time, right? Like, how much can you read and respect writers whose biography shows such blatant sins? I think Dostoevsky, of course, would laugh at such a statement, because it really doesn't admit the sin in everyone's hearts, right? The responsibility we all have for one another, for how many ways we can all go wrong.
So what happened next in that conversation? I mean, if you had the theologians asking that, like, was the general consensus among the students in agreement with the professors, or was there pushback, or what happened?
Praise God, Ralph C. Wood was in charge of the class and he was able to speak into that and basically hold a mirror up to the student asking the question and say, well, should we be listening to you? In what ways has your life been so exemplarily saintly? We can talk to you about what you know about God. Is there really anyone we're going to be talking to who can say that their life was perfect and thus they have a perfect knowledge of the way the world is, the way of who God is, etc.? When Alexei is trying to decide whether or not he's going to care more about people than he is going to care about gambling, he thinks in terms of gambling and says, what am I now? Zero. But what may I be tomorrow? Tomorrow I may rise from the dead and begin to live anew. I may find the man in me who has been lost. And I think that that's a great way of understanding what Dostoevsky's doing, that maybe puts a little bit more spiritual depth into the gambler, as he really is trying to uncover what is the spiritual state of this person that's coming out negatively in gambling. And of course, that's probably the most confessional part of the gambling.
So you mentioned that, you know, people do have this, there is sort of a absorption with this idea in Dostoevsky, and you know, he seemed pretty consumed with his flaws. So in some ways it's not surprising that we all are too. Him being such an open book, you know, leads us to have lots of information on him and to be able to kind of, you know, look at all the things closely that he was naming about himself. But do you think that that is kind of a, I mean, as a literary scholar, as a reader, as a lover of his work, do you think that it's inappropriate to spend a lot of time thinking about those things and trying to understand their impact on his work? Or do you think that that is, I mean, or I guess, do you think it's appropriate?
Right.
Well, it seems to be the two sides there.
I'm probably of the way of reading in which you're always balancing the author's biography with the text itself, with the reader's response, right? So all three of those things kind of form a triangle, and you're judging the work by all three parts and keeping those things in tension. So I'm not of the thought that you would just completely walk away from the biography. It's not going to provide any revelation to the material. And I don't think you can just read the stories by themselves to get the most out of it. I love reading everything else that could go with it.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic synthesis too for whatever is going on in our own hearts and lives that we're able to pay attention in a new way than perhaps even Dostoevsky intended, right? Reading it in the 21st century in America. And we're going to bring new things to light when we read the work. So I would want to look at his gambling. And as you've mentioned, even his relationship, I mean, how did he produce some of the texts that he produced? I think the story of how he met his second wife and how he wrote The Gambler is just one of the most fascinating literary stories, even more than what he wrote down.
Can you talk about that for a little bit? I mean, I know that's like a terrible interview question. Can you talk about this? But can you tell that story for the audience?
Well, it's a fantastic story, and there's actually been a lot of movies made on it. I don't know that any of them are any good, but there was a Russian film that said 26 Days in the Lives of Dostoevsky or something like that, because what happened was he was in such a debt with his creditors, and I mean, it was to the point where he's kind of jumping from place to place to avoid people finding him. And so he makes this horrible loan. The guy's name was something like Stolovsky, and this was just a shark that came after Dostoevsky and said, I'll give you, you know, 3,000. I don't even remember which country he was in, but I'll give you 3,000. And because he was traveling all over Europe at this point. But I'll give you 3,000 if you give me the rights to your novels over the next like 9 years. I mean, that's huge. That would have been, that's a horrible deal to make. Yeah.
But you got to be really desperate to do that.
It's the Jacob and Esau, right? Your birthright for a bowl of soup. And he was that desperate. And the only way he could get out of it is if he turned an entire novel, and the length was even stipulated, turn the novel in by November 1st of 1866. And so it comes to October 4th of 1866, and Dostoevsky has not written a word of this novel. So he has 26 days to write an entire novel. And he had been working on The Idiot at that time and had to kind of put it to the side. And a friend of his hired a stenographer. So a stenographer was kind of a new thing. And women working was definitely a new thing. I mean, it was frowned upon. When his stenographer arrived, her name was Anna Grigorievna, basically like the daughter of Greg. And she showed up. He expected her to smoke and kept offering her cigarettes. And she was so affronted, you know. I think Frank tells the story really well. Like, she was just so affronted that he would even think she was like low class for coming.
She was that kind of girl.
Right. So she just kept, putting him off. And she helped him write for the next 26 days. And they did it. I mean, she was on a mission to do what was right because the shark was taking advantage of this brilliant man from her perspective. And she was 25 years younger than him and just in awe of the great artist. And so she sat there and diligently wrote this entire novel for him. They turned it in, I mean, hours before it was due and had it stamped by a police officer just to ensure its validity. So it was a fantastic story. And it's funny too, because he's writing to get out of gambling debt and the book he chooses to write is about gambling. I mean, it's just fascinating. Hmm.
So at this point, how famous is he at this point? Because Anna has read Crime and Punishment, as I mentioned, when she walked into the room at his apartment, she said, "This looks just like Raskolnikov's." But how famous is he at this point? I mean, he's got to be at least moderately successful for this guy to do. Take on an agreement like that. But I mean, he's not, Tolstoy, right?
Well, he's in conversation with people like Tolstoy and Turgenev. So he's definitely climbing the charts, I guess you could say. Okay. He had become semi-famous 15 years before when he had published, I think it's 15 years, something like that, Poor Folk, which was his socialist novel that no one even reads anymore. But he was a young
man.
Is it
good?
No. I don't really like propaganda, so I prefer his post-Christian works where they're dealing with, universal ideas rather
than
of the times. And so he was basically writing what amounts to propaganda for the Christian socialist movement, and then, of course, gets thrown into prison. But that novel had already put him on the stage. I mean, people were already expecting things of him. And then when he came back from prison, he written Notes from the Underground, which was in response to Chernyshevsky's What is to be Done. And since those two novels kind of became two sides of an argument, everybody was reading them and talking about them. So you were either of the mind that we're going to be progressive and Russia is going to become more modern, more European, the ways of the world, so to speak. We're going to have our own crystal palace, kind of like London had just had. Or we're going to be like Dostoevsky and have this underground man who prizes freedom above all else. And so he'd already kind of made a name for himself, and then Crime and Punishment. So he was becoming famous, not in Europe, only in Russian circles. So St. Petersburg, Moscow. And he was making no money off of anything because he owed so much that as soon as the money came in, it belonged to other people. So he wasn't making a lot of money. He was still living very poor, but people did know who he was at this point, or Russians did. Other Russians knew who he was.
So then Anna comes in knowing who he is, having read Crime and Punishment, as I said. She helps him write this book, but then she sticks by him after that too. So they
turn in the book and he proposes the next day. And so he marries this girl that's, 25 years younger, which causes a lot of conflict from the get-go.
Yeah.
But she makes a very smart decision and takes him around Europe for the next 4 years. So they spend 4 years traveling. It's half good in that they're getting almost an extended honeymoon, but it was also pretty negative because he was so addicted to gambling and he had much more access to it in places like Baden-Baden, right? In Germany. And because he had access, he was losing all their money as quickly as they made it. So he pawned their wedding rings. He pawned the coats off their back. He would pawn things like furniture, things that didn't, just anything he could get his hands on to keep gambling.
So I guess the question that I imagine many listeners or people who are just kind of hearing about this for the first time are saying, well, why was he unable to
control himself? I mean, I know that's, you know, that's a hard question for anybody in any kind of temptation or sin or something that you're addicted to. I mean, but are there clues to exactly what it is that that seemed to be driving him or kind of imprisoning him and keeping him from being able to control himself? Is it just the fact, I don't want to overstate it, but it starts out as the fact that he owes all this money and he's just kind of trapped. Right. But did it go beyond that? I mean, did it go beyond just negative circumstances?
Well, I think there was added pressure after marrying Anna because she was young. So there was some jealousy there. He wanted to make sure to keep her and keep her happy. And he did love her so much. And then of course she becomes pregnant. So that becomes added pressure. I mean, you can kind of imagine a parallel in poverty in America, in which you're so poor and you can't find a way to get a job and your family needs to eat. And then your wife gets pregnant. And so you apply for another credit card and then another one to pay off that credit card. And then you play for another. And pretty soon you are so over your head in debt, you don't know what to do. And just the point of desperation, I think that's what was constantly confronting him. He would get ahead for a brief moment and then lose it again. And he talks about in The Gambler on almost like a fantasy versus fate level, right? The moment where the roulette is spun and you don't know where it's going to land, and it could, your entire fortune and your entire dreams come true and the world will change the way that you start to feel. And then the split second in between could also be your doom on the other side, right? I mean, it could be your wife will hate you and curse you forever. Your child will have nothing to eat and it will all be your fault. And so just the self-loathing versus I will provide for everyone's dreams to come true. And those moments of in between became like a high. I mean, just the liminal space between will I win or will I lose, he fed off just that. I mean, that he talks about that quite a bit in his diaries and letters and also in The Gambler, just that feeling of hanging in suspense between those two goals.
Yeah. In the Frank biography, there's the chapter on The Gambler. He talks about how Dostoevsky thought there was a Russian instinct or susceptibility to that sort of thing. He even called it kind of there's a poetic instinct, I think was how he put it, something like that, in Russians that led them to that sort of thing. So is that, do you think when he writes a novel like The Gambler and, you know, some of his other novels as well, is he trying to in some ways not just sort of write a confessional for himself, for his own sins, but in some way try to express or confess this communal Russian sin or this susceptibility? Is he trying to work that out, do you think?
Well, and I think The Gambler, it's not one of his top five novels for a reason. He does imitate seemingly the novels of Western Europe that were commenting on national personalities. I mean, you had people interacting with Russians and Englishmen and Frenchmen. And so he does that here, but he's almost stereotyping each group. But when he tries to diagnose the Russian character, he's actually hitting on something that I think is more universal. And he talks about the possibility of, you know, utter doom or self-loathing on one side. And then on the other side, this idea sounds almost salvific, right? And it's associated with money. So it's associated with something worldly. But the way he describes it becomes supernatural. And I think the Russian poetic character that he discusses can be applied more generally to, aren't there things that we just put all of our hope and dreams and ambitions into and just, you know, throw the dice? I mean, aren't there ways that happens in our lives? And I think that he hits on that idea a little bit with The Gambler and takes it further in works like The Idiot or The Brothers Karamazov or even Demons. In what ways do we do this in other arenas other than at the gambling table, right? So if he's no longer going to play roulette, what does it mean to play roulette with your life? Mm. And the risk is damnation or salvation. Mm.
So do you, you mentioned that this is something that he calls a Russian susceptibility, but you're saying he's touching on something more universal. Do you think that he's setting out to touch on something universal, or he's setting out to touch on something Russian, but he manages to touch on something universal?
Yeah, I think the latter. I mean, you also have to imagine him in that little apartment going up and down the room. And I think Anna comments at one point, I love that book, her reminiscences. And she said at one point she walked in and she remembers these Chinese vases. And then a few days later, they were gone. So obviously he had pawned them to go gamble. So it became, you know, more and more poor over the 26 days that she was even there, that he was losing hope even as they're trying to put this novel together. So I don't think he's intentionally looking for the, you know, depths of reality in the gamble.
Yeah.
But I think what he strikes upon truth, just trying to put his own soul out there and thinking it's Russian. And then by the end of the book, realizing, okay, what about this? More than Russian, right? And so he creates other characters like Prince Myshkin.
Did he revise heavily, his books heavily, after the manuscripts were finished?
No, because they came out in Chronicle.
Of course. Yeah, of course.
So it wasn't the same process that you would have now. So when you said he's more like Dickens, in that sense, he would be, because he was putting it out in pieces. Now, they were censored heavily, and that was unfortunate.
That'd be an interesting conversation to talk about, whether someone like Dickens or Dostoevsky would have been better had they not been writing it that way and had they had the opportunity to revise. That would be a fascinating conversation. I guess it would depend on what chapter or even what book you're talking about. But so do you see this gambling stuff showing up in The Idiot and Brothers K and some of the other works as well? Do you see that theme? I mean, not necessarily gambling itself as this plot point, but some of the same ideas that he's trying to write about in The Gambler and some of the confessional nature of that. Do you see that as he goes on in his career?
I think there are two ideas that come from The Gambler and begin to take hold in other works. The idea you mentioned, where Russians were a combination of so many opposites at once, right? And he finds that a particularly Russian point. What Dostoevsky ends up doing in the later works is he makes those opposites into two separate characters. And so this becomes his doubling technique. I don't know if you're familiar with his doubling technique.
Well, I am, but what can you define that for the people who are trying to decide whether or not they're going to read Dostoevsky?
So what he does is, it's almost the Jekyll and Hyde, but he splits them into two characters. And so you have one character that's fully the Hyde and one character that's fully the Jekyll. And then he watches them interact with one another. So they're kind of like the two sides of a coin, but you're getting to have a dialogue between those two parts. And I think this works well for readers. If there's one part of you that you hide or pretend is not there or don't appreciate, but watching it in two different characters and then seeing them dialogue, I think allows the reader to almost have a catharsis of having your inner self dialogue.
Yeah, yeah.
Huh. It definitely works well for getting at some of these contrasts. And then the other idea that's there is Nedrev, which Vladimir Nabokov says is an untranslatable word. And some translators use laceration. I think that's what Constant Scarnett uses. But it's this idea that because of some self-loathing or some part of yourself that doesn't feel like it deserves good things, you actually strike out at those that you love and intentionally hurt them so that you can cause yourself pain. It's a very strange idea, but you see it happen in The Gambler. And then of course it takes on more momentum in his later works. And it wasn't just in The Gambler. It was in Notes from Underground. This underground man does the same thing. Nedrev becomes kind of this sick drive to not let oneself be happy in this life. Right? Just because you can.
Does he recognize that as something that he's doing in his own life, or is this sort of a more of a theoretical thing that he's then thinking about it in terms of its value in fiction?
Right. Well, if you read Sigmund Freud on Dostoevsky,
that sounds like quite an afternoon.
And of course, Freud makes up a bunch of stuff that doesn't fit with a biography like by Joseph Frank or something. But yeah. But Freud's analysis would be that he had no idea what he was doing. I don't think that's true, because I think most of what you can read in Dostoevsky, let's say, for example, his desire to kill off fathers in the text, right? Mm. Has so much more to do with what he sees society doing, throwing off the authority of a godhead. And so I think Dostoevsky knows that his fiction is functioning on multiple levels, and whatever is happening for him personally that has universal application, he's then trying to expose and to illustrate that. So yeah, I think it's very intentional. I think he knew what he was doing. And especially if you watch his novels from the early days, from Notes from the Underground to The Brothers Karamazov, I mean, The Brothers Karamazov just becomes a masterwork. It's the greatest novel that has ever been written.
I want to go back to this doubling thing. There was something I wanted to ask you about that. Because in The Gambler, he's kind of divides people by like the Russians and then the Europeans, I guess, right? So they're French, right?
There's a Frenchman and a French woman, and then there's an Englishman, and then
that's right. And then on the other side, it seems like there's the Russians, and it seems like in some ways they're, I don't know, and are they in opposition to each other? I mean, is that an example of his doubling thing there at play? Would you say
what happens in The Gambler is that the doubles are within the characters, so it's a little weird. He actually changes the technique later.
Okay. Okay, I see. Yeah, yeah.
In this, you have Alexei, right? He doesn't have any last name, I don't think. And Alexei says things all the time like, perhaps I will kill you, Paulina. No, yeah. Why would I say that? I love you. So these extremes happen just within Alexei, and they even happen within Paulina, where she's like, I love you, I'm going to throw myself at your feet, and then I hate you, and I'm going to throw money in your face. But later he kind of separates them out a little bit. So by the time you get to Brothers Karamazov, you have the two different women, right? You have Grushenka and Katerina, and they're completely opposite characters that are facing one another and showing two different ideals of what a woman is. Hmm.
Do you think when he does the way he does it in The Gambler, I mean, and you don't necessarily need to criticize one of the greatest writers of all time if you don't want to, but do you think that that's a little bit, like, it's not as, it lacks the subtlety, or is maybe, I don't know, what do people say, a little on the nose or something?
I think it actually lacks the spiritual dimension of his later work. So, you know, when he was in Siberia, the only book he read was the New Testament. And one of the reasons he did so, I mean, besides the fact that that was what all that he had, was because he had just had a mock execution that he didn't know was a mock execution. They blindfolded him, said, you're going to die for your socialist beliefs, and then pulled the blindfold off and said, okay, never mind, now you're just going to Siberia. And so it was, I mean, he saw his life flash before his eyes. And so he became enthralled with the New Testament, and it drove most of his fiction, except it doesn't drive this one. You know, and so what drives The Gambler is the need to pay off his debts, and really for the sake of other people. I mean, I think it's all in his letters at that point, saying things like, what would Mikhail, his older brother, what would his wife do if Dostoevsky is taken to a creditor's prison? She would have nothing. Her four children would have nothing. And so there's just, he's driven by money for this novel. And so he writes almost like a Dickens or a Henry James type novel here, but with a Russian twist. Mm-hmm. And I think his later works, he was able to take his time. I mean, like I said, he put The Idiot to the side to work on this book, and then he went back to what he really loved. So this is a book to pay off a debt. So it just doesn't have the same beauty, doesn't have the same big questions in it that the other works do.
I didn't consciously think about it when I was reading, but it felt more rushed. Like if he was being less precise. And so the problem for me is that I can't read it in Russian. So I don't know how much of it is it's always a question of translation. Like, am I feeling like this chapter was rushed, or is it just that I don't understand what the translator was doing? You know,
well,
so
writing it in 26 days, I think that you were right to find he didn't have a plan. I mean, the moment that Anna got there, he just started talking, and she was writing everything down. And of course, he made notes and went back and would revise things. I mean, she gave him the whole manuscript on October 29th. So his revision process was all of 2 days.
Yeah.
He had to submit it. So there wasn't a lot of structuring ahead of time or creating different plot lines. It was just one person's perspective and moving forward in the story and seeing what happens.
So it's significantly shorter than, say, Brothers K or even Crime and Punishment. And I think the Idiot as well. Mm-hmm. But so you mentioned that it had been arranged what the length was. Was he told he had to write a shorter one, or was
he? This was the minimum, right?
So okay. It was the minimum. Okay.
It was the minimum that he had to meet in order to pay this debt. And I don't remember how it was stipulated in pages at that point. But yes, this was what he had to do in order to pay off the debt. Now, he has written short novels. So Poor Folk is short. House of the Dead, Notes from the House of the Dead, which is right after he gets out of prison, was short. He had published literary magazines, so he had done lots of short pieces, you know, The Dream of Verdi Man and things like that. Notes from the Underground is quite short, it's novella, right? So he was writing those in between, and he writes The Eternal Husband, The Double. So he has lots of small ones. It's just when we think of Dostoevsky, we think of his like great novels, Crime and Punishment.
Yeah.
Demons, The Idiot, Brothers K. And those are kind of the big pieces, masterpieces that he produced.
Well, I know I can't keep you for too much longer, so I've got a couple kind of concluding questions for you here. What is your personal favorite Dostoevsky novel? Like, you can only read, you're stuck in Siberia and you can only have one Dostoevsky novel with you.
That's an easy question. I mean, for me, it's not even one Dostoevsky novel. If there's one work of literature, it would be The Brothers Karamazov. That is the most phenomenal piece of literature that has ever been written.
How many times have you read it?
Oh, goodness me. I began reading it when I was an undergraduate for the first time. So
is it like an annual? You try to read it every year? I mean, I guess you've probably studied it very closely just from an academic perspective as well. So.
I do, right. I got to practice translating with some help when I was at University of Virginia. I studied Russian there for a little bit and got to practice translating some passages when I was working on my book on Dostoevsky. So, right. And I've written two books on Dostoevsky. I don't know. I mean, at least a dozen times. And I teach it annually. This year I taught Notes from the Underground and my students were so disappointed, but I was trying to teach a few other longer works. And I thought, well, I'll just teach Notes from the Underground. And they were so disappointed. I don't think I'll ever do that again.
Well, Notes from the Underground is a good book too.
It's fantastic. Of course. And it's like, I mean, I love it. I love teaching it. But The Brothers Karamazov is just masterful. It's one of those books that teaches you what words mean, right? Like, you thought you knew what love was. It's not until you read this book. You thought you knew what forgiveness meant. Not until you read this book. You thought you knew the hate in your own heart. Not until you read this book. So this book just teaches the human soul so much about itself. Mm.
One of the questions we get a lot is about translation. And I'm curious who, you know, let's just say you're talking Brothers K, but for Dostoevsky in general, there's a couple of, you know, particularly famous ones. You mentioned Constance Garnett, and then there's the Larissa Volokhonsky, and Richard Pevier, yeah. Where do you turn for a do you have a go-to for either of those, or is there someone else?
I think Pevier and Volokhonsky are the great ones for classroom use and for first-time access. I don't think they're the greatest for scholarship, and one of the reasons why would just have to be with process. So Volokhonsky speaks French and Russian, and Pevier speaks English and French. So Volokhonsky translates from Russian into French, and then he translates from French into English.
Oh, okay.
So some things are literally lost in translation.
Yeah.
I would say for accessibility, they use contemporary English so well and so idiomatically that they get at the meaning of the text, and people read it with ease. And you know, Dostoevsky's style can be rather difficult. I mean, he really was packing so many pieces into a sentence. And so, you know, to have this ease is probably preferable, even especially because most people that you're talking to are not going to be scholars. So go with your Dostoevsky.
Where would you start? Speaking of starting, you know, if with Dostoevsky in general, I guess, I mean, would you start with Brothers K if someone's thinking, okay, I know I need to read Dostoevsky, but there's all these different books and some of them are very long. Yeah. They're often kind of dark looking.
How do you not start with Brothers K? You know, if you end up starting with Notes from Underground, you're going to get turned off, because the whole experiment of the Notes from the Underground is you have a man that says, the world is trying to control me. They're trying to either make me into data, or they're trying to make me into an animal, and I'm just going to protest and crawl underground into a hole, right? So it's just it's a dark book in that sense. And then you don't get a full vision for Dostoevsky. It's kind of like people who read only Inferno when they read Dante's Divine Comedy.
Yeah.
From underground. Whereas you have to, the Brothers Karamazov is as difficult to read as Dante's Paradiso, but it has the most reward and the fullness of his vision. So you may just have to go more slowly than you do if you said, you know, you picked up a Flannery O'Connor short story and you could read it and it was accessible and easy. And I mean, not easy as far as like your emotional responses maybe, but you can get at what's happening there fairly quickly. And I don't think you can with Brothers K, and that's okay. It takes humility to even receive the vision that's there in the text, but it's a wonderful story. It's a detective story. It's about murder and trying to solve the case. It's got love triangles. It's got brothers in rivalry. It has questions about what is beautiful. Is there a God? And how do we run society? I mean, it's just a very full novel. So it's worthwhile, even if it takes you 5 years to read.
Yeah. Read a little bit at a time. And you like the PVR and Volokonsky translation of that as well.
Again, for getting started, absolutely.
Yeah.
If you want to dig in more, maybe not, but that would
be so well. Is Garnett then just considered the more literal translation?
No, actually Garnett is not literal at all. I mean, that's okay. The problem with Garnett. So if you don't know the story of Constance Garnett, she discovered the Russians. And like I said, Dostoevsky wasn't famous in Europe because nobody was really translating him until Constance Garnett in the 1920s gets a hold of Dostoevsky, you know, 40 years after he died. And she just loves Russian literature. So she begins translating everything, but you can't tell the difference between a Tolstoy novel and a Dostoevsky novel if you read Constance Garnett.
So they're just Constance Garnett novels.
They're all turned into British English. I mean, she tames everything with him. They're not stylistically different. And part of the reason why is she thought he was just a bad stylist, which is not true. He just had his own style.
Yeah. So, but then was she saying that all the Russians, I mean, if a Tolstoy and a Dostoevsky novel are the same, is she just saying that the Russians were bad stylists in general?
No, because Tolstoy is a Western European stylist. And so Tolstoy writes novels the way Frenchmen write novels.
Okay.
So
she liked those Frenchmen.
Mm-hmm, exactly. Yeah. And so did Turgenev. Turgenev would be more of the Frenchman type of novels, right? Mm. He turned away from Russia and even like turned away his citizenship to Russia.
And
I was just thinking, but Dostoevsky is a Russian novelist.
Was he actively trying to not be that?
Yes.
Russian/European novelist like Tolstoy was?
Oh, yes. He did not love Europe the way that, especially Turgenev loved Europe. They got in all sorts of heated fights over, you know, love of country versus love of Europe. But Tolstoy would not necessarily say that he loved Europe, and yet he was imbibing Enlightenment ideas. Mm. He really was. He thought he was a true Russian, but he wanted to change Russia so much that Dostoevsky would have said, you're not a true Russian.
So let me ask this last question. Was Dostoevsky then, was he trying to preserve, like, was he trying to avoid the Enlightenment taking over Russia? Is that part of what his goal was?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, Dostoevsky wants to go back to the good parts of medieval Russia and bring them up. So the good parts meaning not serfdom. He was all about the serfs are the wise ones among us. They're the holy fools. We have it recognized. So he wouldn't have wanted to, you know, reinstitute serfdom. But what he would have wanted was this holistic vision, right? The idea that the church was the center of everything, and that the Russian spirit, right, the noble Russian spirit that had not been influenced. Whereas when Peter came in and decided everything needed to be French, and then Catherine came in and decided all of us need to follow Voltaire. And I guess he wanted to go before both of them back to what he thought was pure Russia, right? Mm. And that if they did, then Russia could save the world. I mean, if there's any problems with Dostoevsky biographically, I don't think it's his gambling. I think it's the fact that he literally thought Russia would save the world if everyone became Russian.
Well, the right kind of Russians, of course.
Right kind of Russians. There you go. Right? His tribe.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, I'll let you go. I know you got
it. Well, thank you to Dr. Jessica Houghton-Wilson for joining me for this conversation. As always, don't forget about all the great content here at the Close Reads Podcast Network. Not only can you listen to Libromania, but you can join us in all of our other podcasts, all of our other literary conversations. We have The Daily Poem, where we're bringing you one poem each weekday. Close Reads, our flagship show, where you can join us as we discuss novels and other great works of literature. We've got The Plays the Thing, where we are reading Shakespeare one act at a time. We are currently reading through Macbeth, if you'd like to join us. And we have a number of other podcasts on the way coming soon. So be on the alert. Make sure you're subscribing. We would really appreciate it if you would rate and review the shows. Please rate and review this show if you liked this episode. It's a great way to help us spread the word and to let us know how we're doing. So for all of us here at the Close Reads Podcast Network, I'm David Kern. Thanks so much for listening and happy reading.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.